belonged to another.
Oh. It wasn't that Ryan found sleep elusive. He never caught so much as a fleeting glimpse of it. He lay with Christy on a narrow bed in one of the bunk rooms. The others had considerately allowed him and Christy to occupy one room, in case they wanted privacy. Presumably, JB and Mildred shared another of the rooms, while Doc, Jack, and Dean bedded down in the third. Their consideration, as much as he appreciated it, was wasted. Both he and Christy slept fully clothed. She stirred fitfully in her sleep, and though she continued to sleep, she was restless, moving frequently, a thread of spittle at a corner of her mouth. As tired as he was, Ryan was sore and itchy. Not only did his muscles ache, but the salt residue of his ocean swim had dried upon and irritated his skin. He continued trying to capture sleep, but every time he closed his eye, the image of the grinning, flame-eyed skull bobbed to the surface of his mind like a malevolent cork.
Not your queen. Not your mother.
Ryan started up, shaken by an eerie fear. He listened, and when all he could hear was Christy's slightly labored breathing, he got out of the bed. He stared down at her in the dim light, and when he realized he was scratching his salt-stiff hair, he turned away. Quietly, he left the room, went out into the hallway, and entered the shower room. Peeling off his clothes, he placed them on a bench near the door. He chose the farthermost tiled enclosure and turned on the faucet. A spray of water jetted from the nozzle, and he adjusted it until it was a needle-like rain. When the water was hot enough, almost at the extreme of the tolerance level, he stepped beneath the flow. He used a liquid soap dispenser affixed to the wall to work the lather all over his bruised and scarred body. The entire room filled quickly with billowing clouds of steam. As he washed, he thought back to the last time he and Christy had made love. It had been quite some time ago, in a shower room very much like this one, and she had crept up behind him. A repetition of that night wasn't likely to happen now, even if he felt up to it. Christy was in a sleep so deep that nothing could rouse or arouse her. He contented himself with luxuriating beneath the driving jets of hot water, letting them soothe the muscle ache. Mildred continued to examine the material that explained Dr. O'Brien's role at the installation.
Phase one of Mission Invictus had been conducted on primates and was already a biological fait accompli before I joined the staff in early 1999. The subject animals' cells and DNA retained their structural integrity despite exposure to radiation and its concomitant free radical damage. The only side effect of the genetic recombination had been a bizarre pigment change in the eyes when the test animals reached maturity. For a reason the scientists could only speculate upon, their eyes turned red, though their vision was apparently unimpaired. When over Project Excalibur resettled the 12 mission personnel, 8 men and 4 women, including me, in the isolated redoubt, the apes had to be put down. Though deeming Phase 1 a success, the overseers didn't want a race of super chimps running around the installation like something out of a bad sci-fi movie. You who made that decision had, in effect, made apes of yourselves when you demanded the creation of a superhuman. Phase 2 proved more difficult. Out of a group of 30 fertilized ova, only 10 survived the first in vitro gestation period, and only 2 survived the entire neomutagenic process, but in a work so unprecedented and so technical that it combined all aspects of biophysics and cell fusion techniques, no one could possibly have anticipated all the variables. Stabilization of the basic genetic material, human beings, when exposed to the synthetic mutagen, had proved to be a problem. Though it had eventually been overcome, the solution arrived after the nuclear firestorm reshaped the face of the world. However, once the fundamental limitations of Phase 2 were overcome, the Phase 3 level was quickly achieved. The 2 surviving subjects, a male and a female, designated as Alpha and Epsilon, matured to the toddler stage within a month. Instead of being exultant, fear was the primary reaction. You are ordinary men. No matter how powerful you think you are, you cannot envision my concept of a super being, bred to survive in the world you created. You wanted me to return to the original project of generational accelerated growth cycles. That I could not do. What you believed would require 10 years or more was reduced to a mere 18 months. The Alpha and Epsilon subjects showed extraordinary manual dexterity and heightened cognitive abilities almost from the moment they emerged from the incubation chambers. The infants possessed IQs so far beyond the range of standard tests as to render them meaningless. They mastered language in a matter of weeks, speaking in whole sentences, albeit grammatically incorrect. Physically, Alpha and Epsilon were the epitomes of perfect human development. The structural properties of their bodies had been successfully modified while still in their in vitro wombs. All of God's design faults in human physiology were corrected. Yes, the infants were perfect, despite the ruby-red hue of their eyes. Some of the scientists on the staff had problems relating to them because of this characteristic, referring to them half-jokingly as children of the damned. As the children grew at an astonishing rate, I made a point of stopping by their nursery every night to tuck them in. Epsilon would always smile up into my face and with pudgy baby fingers toy with the strands of my long red hair, asking me questions in her high, piping, sweet voice. Alpha, on the other hand, would gaze solemnly up into my face and never smile or reach for me. He silently studied me, examined me, inspected me, and, as I suspected, judged me. When the infants had developed to the physical age of 3.5 years old, but chronologically only 6 months out of the incubation tanks, the accident happened. A door lock mechanism jammed, a pressure gauge malfunctioned, and a routine test in a hyperbaric chamber went horribly awry. Epsilon was in the chamber at the time, and when I realized something was wrong, I lost all of my scientific objectivity. The child's eyes behind the glass of the chamber were wide and sad, and I screamed frantically at the technician in charge to do something, to do anything. Epsilon suffocated, and my heart broke. The child's death was the demarcation point between what the mission had been and what it became. The atmosphere of the redoubt resembled that of people trapped aboard a slowly but inexorably sinking ship. I grew obsessively protective of Alpha. He, too, seemed changed by his sibling's death. His face took on a fixed, watchful expression. In the months following Epsilon's suffocation, staff members began complaining of insomnia, and when they managed to sleep, of nightmares. Accidents became the usual rather than anomalies. At first, I attributed the occurrences to stress. I suspected that the staff's fear of what was being bred within the walls of the installation was far greater than what the Holocaust might have spawned outside them. By the first anniversary of Alpha's emergence from the artificial womb, he had read voraciously of the volumes of books in the database. He absorbed the wisdom amassed over thousands of years of human history, and he began to extrapolate on that wisdom. Though I encouraged his exposure to such survival of the fittest proponents as Spencer and Hobbes, he wasn't much interested in their philosophies. Alpha's area of special interest lay in ancient history, specifically the civilizations of the Nile. Egypt, with its dynasties of mighty god-kings bestriding the earth, its culture, architecture, and religions, obsessed him. The rebellious 18th dynasty pharaoh Akhenaten in particular fascinated him. His hyperactive mind pondered the same questions that had perplexed the pharaoh thousands of years before. Human history appeared to be essentially one war after another. For every golden flash of harmony, there were hundreds of blood-spattered conflicts. Was it that man was unable to control his animal instincts and therefore his environment in order to attain a perfect society? Alpha was certainly aware of the hellish conditions outside the Shielded Redoubt, but he didn't yet know who he was or what he was capable of doing. He sought an answer to that mystery by searching through the historical database. In a short time, he acquired a working knowledge of 9 of the ancient written languages of the Nile Valley. In those documents, he found more than an identity. He found a means to an end. The information copied from the eons-old papyri contained more science and less mythological esoterica than he expected. While he studied, more of the parahuman abilities bred into him began to exhibit themselves. Alpha learned he could control all autonomous functions of his brain and body, even the manufacture and release of chemicals and hormones. He could speed or slow his heartbeat, increase and decrease the amount of adrenaline in his bloodstream. He possessed complete control over that mysterious portion of the brain known as the limbic system, a portion that scientists had always known in a detached, meaningless way, possessed great reserves of electromagnetic power and strength. With this mastery of the mind, Alpha was both telepathic and empathic, and something else entirely, something quite unexpected and frightening to everyone but me. He could, and oftentimes did, subtly influence the emotional states and thoughts of others, particularly if they were fatigued, depressed, or asleep. He knew instantly if one of the mission personnel disliked him. One man, Carlson by name, made no secret of his antipathy toward the child. In a casual conversation, he referred to him as Old Hell Eyes. The name stuck thereafter. It didn't seem to offend Alpha, very little did, but I forbade anyone to say it, even in jest. A week after Carlson first coined Hell Eyes, he was found dead in his bunk of cerebral hemorrhage. Over the subsequent year and a half, four more mysterious deaths followed. They were duly recorded and reported. By the time of the last death, Alpha had reached the physical development stage of 16 years old. He was already edging 6 feet tall, perfectly proportioned, with the flat-muscled body of a young Hercules. He wore his hair close to the scalp, like an ebony skullcap. His features were beautiful, yet at the same time undeniably masculine. Only his crimson eyes detracted from his beauty. It was during this stage that Alpha passed through puberty, and another aspect of Phase 3 began to assert itself. The gene-introduced life force that determined his behavior and vitality came to the fore. The visceral desire to procreate. Obviously, with the loss of Epsilon, Alpha began to look elsewhere for a mate. He showed no interest in the other female staff members, though they are younger than myself. He chose me. Yes, of course, I realize he stimulated my very basic sexual urges. On another level, how can a mere mortal refuse a god? For the past 3 months, we've been engaging in coitus regularly. Oh, why be coy about it? We've been fucking. I doubt Alpha understands the concept of love. He understands only the instinct to spread his seed. Unfortunately, I cannot help him fulfill that instinctive desire. I'm barren. I always have been. I'm sure the increased levels of radiation leaking in through the shielding have rendered the other women here sterile as well. And that is our present situation. Even though Alpha is immune to the toxins and radiation outside the installation, he will not find the mate he seeks out there, at least not for a very long time. 80-odd years, I estimate. I received your transmission to abort the mission. I will not obey it. I will not accept that all my work is for nothing and that Mission Invictus, with its hopes for a sane world, is forever aborted as well. Mission Invictus was conceived by you as the penultimate plan to produce a superior human. I admit that I failed you on that point. I produced a god, an entity whose mutated antibodies and immune system will not succumb to the poisonous post-war environment. Whether you impotent bastards care to acknowledge it, over Project Excalibur has been the instrument of fate in this epical hour of humanity's bloody history. Within seconds of transmitting this recording to you, I will deactivate the gateway. There will be no way in or out of this installation except over land. Then, as Alpha has agreed to be placed in stasis, but not in a cryonics canister, he will continue to grow, his development will proceed, but at a vastly reduced rate. He will slow his metabolism to a crawl, his need for oxygen curtailed to what exists within his sarcophagus. His heart might pump once a month. When he is ready, he will revive on his own. Once Alpha is settled, my staff and I will take a long walk outside, our first in many years. With no way to receive food and other provisions, staying here simply delays the inevitable. Alpha will need what remains in the stores when he awakens. Besides, I'm curious to tour this brave new world your machinations have created. Yes, Alpha altered the personnel's perception so they will faithfully follow me. Cold-blooded to an extent, I cannot deny. However, considering my audience, that is the novice speaking to the masters of the art. If any of you are still alive when Alpha emerges from this tomb, know that you will be instantly rendered obsolete. All of your plans, schemes, and grand dreams to control mankind under one whip will come to nothing. You will inherit the slag heap. Alpha will ascend to the throne of eternity and spit upon you. Dr. Connett O'Brien, final report.
When the hand fell upon her shoulder, it required all of Mildred's self-control to keep from screaming. As it was, she had twisted in her chair and whipped her elbow backward.
Dark night, Millie!
I'm sorry, John. But you really shouldn't sneak up on people who are preoccupied.
I wasn't sneaking. It's not my fault you weren't watching your back. Did she preoccupy you? Who is she?
A very brilliant, very disturbed woman. The mother and lover of a god.
What?
I'll explain later. Where's everybody else?
Asleep, I guess. Except for Ryan. He's taking a shower.
Good. Let's go.
To watch him take a shower?
To the lab. There's a story I have to confirm.
We've had this discussion, Millie.
We had it before I knew the backstory about this place.
Well, I don't know it.
And I'll tell you. But checking on the details will determine how long or how short our stay will be here. Trust me, John. Or humor me. We can always use the metasterile unit to decontaminate ourselves.
JB took Mildred's hand, and they went through the office and out into the corridor. A dozen yards to their right, they saw Christy walking toward them. The expression on her finely chiseled face was strangely fixed, her eyes wide, but unblinking.
Christy, you all right?
The Titian-haired woman's deliberate, measured stride didn't falter. Her eyes didn't flick toward them. Without a word or a sign of acknowledgement, she turned into the open door of the shower room.
What's wrong with her? She's sleepwalking or what?
Ryan will look after her. Come on.
A hand touched Ryan's back, and he jumped and whirled. Fighting back a surprised curse, Christy materialized out of the rolling vapors like a wraith, her limbs glistening with droplets of water. She was naked and perfect. Her tumbles of crimson hair fell over her damp shoulders. Her big, slightly tilted eyes gleamed with a brilliant emerald light. The expression in them was so intensely single-minded that Ryan was startled into speechlessness for a long moment. He had seen passion in those eyes countless times, but always they were misted by love. Now the hard green glint was unsoftened by any emotion other than a raging desire, a consuming lust.
Again in the shower? It's getting to be a habit, lover.
Christy didn't reply in words. Her long-fingered hands ran over his face, touching the scar on his left cheek. They trailed across his chest, one sharp nail tracing the thin line of hair that stretched over his flat belly to thicken darkly below it. Ryan stared into her eyes, reading nothing there but an erotic urgency. He felt his muscles tighten under her touch. Leaning forward, Christy tongued his chest as her hands went to his erection, petting and stroking it. She slowly lowered herself to her knees, dragging her tongue down his torso, leaving a trail of heat along his skin. Ryan rested his hands atop her head as his hips began an involuntary back-and-forth motion. Her hand gripped him tightly, in a firm, almost painful grasp.
Not yet. Not yet.
Tugging at him, Christy guided him down until he lay flat on his back on the warm, wet tiles. She straddled his thighs, lifting herself up, then slowly impaled herself. She bit her lower lip, her face a slit-eyed mask of concentration.
Oh!
When he was fully embedded within her velvet liquid heat, she began to ride him roughly. Fingernails digging into his chest, she rocked back and forth, thrust up and down shallowly in a wild, abandoned rhythm. Feeling the boiling approach of an orgasm, Ryan writhed beneath her.
Love her.
Instantly, her wild pelvic motion ceased. With superb control, her internal muscles closed around him, squeezing like a determined fist, preventing the explosion.
Not yet. Not yet. Oh, more to see.
When she was sure that Ryan's climax had been averted, she went to all fours on the floor, her back arched, head down, and resting on her forearms, rear end curved sharply upward. Ryan rose to his knees behind her, hands grabbing her sleek, flaring hips. The sight of her fanned the flames of lust in him until he was completely unaware of anything else. She wriggled her backside, and with one forward thrust, he glided full length into her.
Oh! The august god found her as she slept in the beauty of her palace. She woke because of the savor of the god, and she laughed in the presence of his majesty. Ah! He came to her straight away. He was ardent for her. He gave his heart unto her, let her see him in the form of a god after he came before her. She rejoiced in beholding his beauty. His love went through her body. Then the majesty of God did all that he desired with her. She let him rejoice over her. How great is your fame! Oh, you have united me with your favors. Oh, your dew is in all my limbs. Oh!
Christy sagged beneath him, collapsing face down on the floor. Ryan fell forward, supporting himself above her by quivering arms. Slowly, his senses returned to him, and his hips stopped moving. She lifted her head, looking over a bare shoulder at him, her wet hair plastered to her face, only one wide green eye visible. She squirmed away from him and sat up quickly, raking her hair from her face, staring around in a near panic.
Ryan, what's going on? How did I get here?
I guess you walked.
I was asleep. Last I remember was lying next to you. I was asleep.
Maybe you sleepwalked.
Somnambulist sex? That's a new one for me.
First time for everything, lover.
Ryan got to his feet, extending a hand toward her. For a moment, Christy appeared reluctant to take his hand. She reached out, caught it, and Ryan pulled her up, holding her against him. He tried to kiss her, but she averted her face.
Something's wrong. I was too exhausted to move, much less do what we just did.
What are you saying?
I remember doing what we did, but it was like I was somebody else, or you were somebody else. Something controlled me, like I was a puppet, testing my sexual responses, seeing what I could do, what I would do. It wasn't like when the other possessed me. This was on a deeper, far more primal level than that.
Like the time when you were under Ka's influence?
She wheeled, not responding to the question, and hurriedly walked out of the alcove. Ryan turned off the water and went to the bench where he had left his clothes. Christy was dressing quickly, worming into jeans, not bothering to dry herself. Her crookedly buttoned, white sleeveless blouse clung to her wet breasts.
Well, at least you had enough presence of mind not to walk around the redoubt buck-ass naked. Talk to me, Christy. Something must have happened to you when we made the jump.
Why do you say that?
Because something happened to me, too. But it didn't make me sleep screw or spout poetry in the middle of it.
I did that? Wait, I remember now. Not poetry, exactly.
No, not exactly. I'm afraid I was too involved to catch very much of it. It had to do with a god's favors and some such overblown romantic shit.
You're a true sentimentalist, lover. But you're right, something happened to me during the jump.
Like what?
I dreamed I was in a palace room, beautifully furnished. I was aching for my beloved to join me in bed.
Me?
Yes. No, I don't know. Anyway, I got scared. I called for you.
I heard you.
I ran out of the room. Then I saw... him.
Him? Let me guess. He had eyes burning like the fires of hell?
Yes. You saw him too?
Saw it. He had a skull instead of a face.
That's not what I saw. He was a big man. He wanted me.
Wanted you for what?
I'm not really sure. Wanted me for his mate, for his queen, for his mother.
All of those in one package? He doesn't want much, does he?
I can't be sure of the impressions I received. There's only one thing I am sure of. Whoever he is, he knows we're here. He knows I'm here. He's been waiting for me a long time.
Who? Who's been waiting for you?
A god.
JB and Mildred walked quickly down the corridor to the disc-shaped steel portal. She tapped in the entry code, and the hatch rolled aside. Beyond it, the maze of sterile equipment glittered beneath the cold fluorescent tubes on the ceiling. The big room was broodingly silent and lifeless. JB followed Mildred in, and together they walked down the aisle between two long trestle tables bearing large-scale fermentation tanks, a purification system, and petri dishes. A massive electron microscope stood on a separate table. In one corner, Mildred saw an oscilloscope, a fluoroscope, and a stainless steel liquid nitrogen tank. The lid was open, revealing the honeycomb pattern of individual containers that had once held fertilized human embryos. Mildred stooped in front of a small refrigerator and twisted the latch. Cool air spilled out.
It still works!
Looking over her shoulder, JB saw dozens of small capped bottles resting on wire shelves. Mildred picked up a few.
Penicillin, oreomycin, terramycin, streptomycin, tetracyclines.
What are all those?
Broad-spectrum antibiotics. Before we leave this place, we're taking as many of the non-perishable ones as we can carry. I'll look around for syringes.
Okay. And what else are we looking for?
Mildred walked to the far armaglass-covered wall. Peering through a pane, she saw a cylindrical hyperbaric chamber and other instruments and pieces of equipment that were unfamiliar to her. She found a door set between a pair of armaglass slabs and opened it.
Now what?
On the wall were six rectangular metal panels. Only two bore small burnished plates beneath toggle switches. Mildred bent, peering at one of the plates.
Epsilon subject, female, 3 months, phase 3.
She thumbed the toggle. The panel swung open on oiled pivots, and an oblong transparent canister slid out upon a steel frame. Inside the tube, covered by a sheet of plastic, lay the skeletal remains of an infant.
Dark night. A baby.
Yeah. A baby born to serve a specific function in a world she never made.
Mildred pushed the tube back, closed the panel, and stepped to the next one.
Alpha subject, male. 2.2 years, phase 3.
Flipping the toggle, the door popped open, and another canister slid out. This contained nothing but air.
This is what I was afraid of. He awakened.
Who awakened?
Mildred pushed the canister back, slamming the panel shut.
Get everybody up. There are things we need to talk about. Now!
Christy and Ryan stepped out of the shower room, just as JB and Mildred came swiftly down the corridor. Their postures telegraphed their anxiety to Ryan, and he snapped instantly to an alert mode.
Strategy session time.
Why?
Get everybody together. I only want to tell this story once. That might be all we have time for.
It took a few minutes to rouse Dean, Jack, and Doc. They stumbled into the kitchen, knuckling sleep sand from their eyes, and took places around the table.
I was having the most wonderful dream. I was at Charles Rector's restaurant on Broadway, just about to dig into a 9-course meal with Diamond Jim Brady.
None of us are interested in your culinary fantasies about a 19th-century glutton, Doc. This is real, and it's important.
Then pray proceed, Dr. Wyeth.
At one time or another, I've bored all of you with my theories about the muties running rampant over the face of Deathlands.
Yeah? You say radiation Couldn't account for different types. Mutis too varied and too numerous. So?
So my theories have been confirmed, at least up to a point. Though I can't be positive, I'm fairly sure Over Project Excalibur was a subdivision of the totality concept. The purpose of this installation was devoted not just to creating mutants, but to the birthing of the missing link. The biological bridge between pre-dark and post-dark man. A superhuman designed to thrive in the world created by the nuclear Armageddon.
With that preamble, Mildred told her companions everything she had learned from Connaught O'Brien's recording. She soft-pedaled the hard science, placing her emphasis on the fact that the Alpha subject was more than likely alive and afoot, even after 15-plus years.
It's a rat-blasted wasteland out there. Even a super-mutie like Lord Ka would have a problem surviving.
A super-mutie, maybe, but not a god.
A god.
O'Brien might have been overstating his abilities a trifle, but she was a stiff-spined scientist, too. If she believed Hell Eyes could
Hell Eyes?
A nickname for the Alpha subject because of his red eyes.
Gaia, that explains...
Explains what?
After exchanging a quick, furtive glance with Ryan, Christy told her companions about the jump nightmare, saying she had suspected it was something else. Ryan related his own hallucinatory experiences.
I, too, underwent a brief waking dream. For a few minutes after making the transit, I thought I saw stone walls bearing Egyptian art.
That was some kind of glitch in the gateway system. An accident. What me and Christy went through was psionic, not mechanical.
Still and all, Hell Eyes knows we're here, wherever he might be. With his psi abilities, he sensed our arrival. For all we know, he might have planned it, since O'Brien claimed to have deactivated the gateway.
Maybe he turned it back on when he woke up, then jumped someplace else.
Maybe. But if we can believe O'Brien, Hell Eyes woke up at least 15 years ago. Even if he made a few transits elsewhere, he'd return here.
Why do you make that assertion?
O'Brien indicated that some sort of breeding instinct was bred into him. Like a salmon, he probably has the urge to return here, where he was spawned, to mate.
He not a fish?
No, nor is he a human. Whatever he is, we need to distance ourselves from his sphere of influence. Let's not think that just because he's not here in front of us, he doesn't represent a threat.
Should I say it, or does somebody else want the honor?
Say what, Dad?
Let's get the fuck out of here.
It took the friends only a few minutes to collect their belongings and troop down the corridor to the Matran's chamber. Dean had stowed a few of the sealed ration packs in his duffel, and Jack carried freshly filled canteens. Mildred ducked into the laboratory to retrieve the bottles of antibiotics. After a quick search, she also found a sealed package of disposable syringes.
You know, Millie, we might want to visit the Metasterile unit before we go on our way.
O'Brien made no references to any infectious organisms. I think we're safe. Besides, we've got the medicines, right?
Right.
Inside the Matran's unit, the seven people found places on the interlocking pattern of raised floor discs. Ryan stood by the door, waiting for his friends to position themselves before he pulled it shut to initiate the automatic jump mechanism.
Ready?
He quickly crossed the chamber and sat down between Dean and Christy. He waited for the subsonic hum to begin, for the hexagonal discs to exude their familiar glow. He waited. And waited. Nothing happened. Everyone's eyes darted back and forth, first in puzzlement, then in growing fear. Ryan returned to the armor glass door, opened it, and pulled it firmly shut. Nothing happened. No whine, no glow, no spark shot missed. He pushed open the door again, carefully inspecting the circuitry actuator on the lock, making certain full contact was achieved. He slammed it closed and stood silently in baffled anger.
I think we get the idea. We can't leave this place by the gateway.
Thing worked before.
JB moved to the door and shouldered it open. He examined the circuitry carefully, running his fingers over it.
Damned if I could find anything wrong.
Hell Eyes. He's interfering with the machinery.
Hell Eyes my ass. However the bastard was made, he's just another mutie. It's probably daylight by now. Let's take a look-see outside.
Ryan stamped out of the chamber. He stalked down the corridor in a fast, angry stride. Reaching the sector before the others, he threw up the lever, his emotions making him reckless. Ryan fisted his Sig Sauer, ready to trigger it at anything with legs, no matter how few or how many. A flood of brilliant sunlight all but blinded him. Shielding his eye from the sun's assault, he stepped cautiously out of the recessed doorway. As his vision adjusted to the glare, he saw a dead land stretching away in drifting dunes of ochre and saffron. Judging by the position of the sun, he figured it was only a few hours after dawn. The air was already parched and hot. The heat was deceptive, almost comfortable at first. Then Ryan began to sweat profusely, globes of perspiration springing to his brow and body. Within moments, he felt like a walking swamp. His companions joined him, blinking and grimacing at the high temperature. Ryan turned around to study the exterior of the redoubt. It was a gray half-dome, nearly buried on all sides by sand drifts.
Where is this place?
JB took the compact sextant from the pocket of his coat. Pushing back the brim of his hat, he squinted into the eyepiece and took the necessary sighting. Then from another pocket, he withdrew a crumpled chart and consulted it.
Near as I can figure, we're in California, near Guadalupe, a town a good ways inland and about 150 miles north of what used to be Los Angeles.
I thought California sank into the sea.
Most of it did. At least a lot of it to the south of the San Andreas Fault took a permanent dip. What was left became the Western Islands, remember?
Yeah. Place stunk of sulfur like rotten eggs. Place where we last saw Trader.
JB stowed the sextant and chart back into his coat. He checked his lapel rad counter.
If it's any consolation, we're not on one of those bastard islands. Best as I recollect, folks call this region the Barrens. Nothing and nobody around for 100 square miles. Mid-range yellow. Tolerable.
Santa been out here. Look.
It took everyone a few seconds to discern what the teenager was pointing at. Two narrow, parallel grooves 4 feet apart, nearly obscured by the breeze-driven sand, cut through the desert, disappearing into the distance and the heat shimmer.
Wheels.
Yeah, wooden wheels like a cart. Broad axle base, too.
Not a gasoline-powered wag. No horse or mule tracks around, either.
Jack knelt, pinching a few grains of sand from one of the shallow gouges.
Week old. Maybe 10 days.
Then it appears the so-called Barrens are inhabited, in some fashion. It also appears our only option is to strike off on foot. That is a small comfort, but at least we have a semblance of a path to follow.
Right, Doc. That's what spooks me.
Back inside the redoubt, all of them reached the same conclusion without a protracted discussion. The supply of food was limited in the extreme, so they had no choice but to move out overland. Traveling by night was a necessity, and no one objected to staying in the climate-controlled redoubt until sundown. They used the time to catch up on missed sleep and to put together survival provisions for a bootleather journey.
We might be strolling into a trap.
If the red-eyed bastard is as bright as Mildred says he is, then he'll know that we know. Traps can really only work when you're not ready for them.
There is one possibility we have not considered. Alpha, or Hell Eyes, or whatever we care to call him, might not mean us any harm.
I consider that possibility. I don't find it very probable. Do you?
No.
Even as agitated as he was, Ryan badly needed rest, and he took to one of the bunks shortly after returning to the redoubt. Christy lay down beside him. When the deep, steady rhythm of his breathing told her he was fast asleep, she got up and paced through the corridor. She found Mildred in the laboratory, searching the medical stores. Mildred looked up from deciphering a label on a bottle of tablets.
Christy, what's wrong?
Am I that easy to read?
That unstable coiffure of yours is. Tell me about it.
You mentioned Lord Ka earlier. His influence over us, particularly me.
Jack, too, remember?
Something like it is happening again. I didn't tell you everything about my jump nightmare, or what happened later between me and Ryan.
Christy bluntly told Mildred of her vision of the red-eyed man, her feelings during it, and of how her sexual desires had been aroused to a fever pitch while she slept the sleep of the utterly exhausted.
And you don't remember making love to Ryan?
It was like I was in a trance, performing for someone. My capacity for passion, my inhibitions were being stimulated, tested. I think I passed.
As I recall, Lord Ka invoked your mating instinct and your loyalty.
How close are the two incidents?
Superficially similar. But with Ka, it was the result of his psionic powers and the Mattran's mind meld. After a jump, whatever spell he had over me was broken. In this case, the emotional resonances are much more sensual, more primitive. Lust, possessiveness, and even maternal feelings are all mixed up inside of me.
Oh, sweet Christ. I should have guessed.
Guessed what?
Connaught O'Brien was both mother and lover to Alpha. Physically, you resemble her. Red hair, green eyes, though you're considerably younger.
I don't get you.
Rudimentary psychology. The first protosexual feelings a male child experiences are often directed toward his mother. O'Brien played that role for Alpha, and later he influenced her to become his lover. Though I doubt he had to go much out of his way to entice her. He's a god with very human failings, an Oedipus complex for one. I think he's transferred it to you. If the situation weren't so serious, it'd almost be comical.
I don't see much humor in it. I'm afraid to go to sleep. Afraid he'll try to make me perform again.
I don't blame you. But if it's any consolation, I imagine you can put up psychic shields against his influence. Besides, he's probably learned what he wanted to learn. Next time, though.
Next time, though. It may be in the flesh.
You were too strong for Ka.
Barely. Alpha's influence operates on a different level entirely. Lust, love, protectiveness. I may not be able to withstand all of that.
We'll all help you, when and if the time comes.
That's the problem, isn't it? When and if the time comes, I might not want you to.
The flat western horizon slowly swallowed the sun, painting the sky a lurid red and splashing the desert with purple pastels. Ryan, Christy, Dean, Jack, JB, Doc, and Mildred moved out of the redoubt. The silver-haired man used the ferrule of his ebony sword stick to punch in the three-digit code on the keypad. The massive slab of vanadium steel slowly moved down, the bottom edge joining the floor. The redoubt had been stripped of everything useful that could be carried. Besides the dozen jugs of water distributed among the seven friends, they also packed bed linens to serve double duty as tents and makeshift burnouses if need be. Ryan followed the wheel trace cutting across the desert floor, and the others followed him. In the short span of time between the setting of the sun and rise of the moon, the desert became shrouded in more than dark. It was pitch black, and JB unlimbered a small flashlight so they wouldn't lose the trail. Mildred stumbled over an irregularity in the ground and would have fallen if Dean hadn't caught her.
I thought desert nights were supposed to be clear.
Yeah, well, they're supposed to be cool, too. This one is almost as hot as the day.
By the time a half moon had risen, providing enough illumination so JB could turn off the flashlight, they had trudged over 3 miles. Christy, snatching a backward glance, see no hint of the half-dome of the redoubt rearing out of the sands. Though the sandy soil was hard-packed, they occasionally crossed areas where it was loose, and their feet bogged down in it. Fortunately, except for a few shallow dunes and drifts, the terrain was bored flat. After 3 hours, Ryan called a halt so they could rest and drink. They sat down and passed around a jug of water, drinking sparingly.
Was this place so desolate before the new cost?
Pretty near. Believe it or not, this area was popular with Hollywood movie makers.
Why?
It could double for any place. The Old West, alien planets, even countries in the Middle East.
I see very little that would stimulate the imagination or hold much in the way of entertainment value.
What's so funny, Dad?
A couple of days ago, we were surrounded by more water than I ever wanted to see. I remember saying to myself that if I ever got back to dry land, the only body of water I'd ever go near again would be a bathtub. And now this.
Well, if we wanted to turn south, we'd come to the Pacific by and by. According to my old chart, it's about 80 or so miles away, maybe closer now.
Yeah, this is just like Trader used to say. Be careful what you wish for, because you'll be bastard sorry when you finally get it.
A version of that bromide was popular in my time. We used to call cliches like that bumper sticker philosophy.
Say what?
Well, before Skydark, almost everybody in America owned cars. Companies used to manufacture little adhesive signs with the silly slogans of the day printed on them, and people would stick them on the bumpers of their cars. Things like "Keep on Truckin'" or "Beam me up, Scotty, there's no sign of intelligent life on this planet." Well, I guess you had to be there.
I remember seeing one back in a New York salvage yard. It said, "Honk if you're horny."
Well, time to move. No matter where we're headed, we need to find some kind of shelter before the sun rises.
Eventually, the temperature dropped just enough to make the air comfortably cool. As the hours wore on, the endless ocean of sand began to sprout sparse signs of life. Sagebrush, cactus, and ocotilla shrubs grew from the desert floor in thin silhouettes of shadow. At one point, they spotted a peculiar humped hillock a dozen yards to their right. Ryan and Jack noted how the wheel tracks veered sharply away from it, then resumed their northwesterly direction. The companions followed the slight detour without question.
You remember that giant sand spider back in White Sands?
Yeah, too damn well.
All of them increased the length and speed of their stride for the next eighth of a mile. They managed to maintain the sprightly pace for another hour. After rising from a midnight rest break, the seven companions moved slower. Dean noticed that Doc was lagging behind, and he dropped back to offer him an arm. Doc waved him away, but acknowledged the boy's concern with an appreciative smile.
No need, young gentleman. I'm merely conserving my strength in case it is needed for running.
Not much to run from, or to, around here, Doc.
That's one of the truly invigorating elements about following your father. The situation could change at any moment.
I really missed all of you when I was in school. I didn't miss all the running, though.
Our portion, I fear. The lot of the survivor, to run from one broken dream to another.
Pick up the pace back there.
See what I mean?
For the next couple of hours, nobody talked much. Silence lay upon the arid vista of emptiness with a crushing hand. Then, from far off, came a faint sound. Jack jogged forward to join Ryan.
Storm coming. That way.
How long?
Hour, maybe. Maybe more. Maybe less.
Ryan ground his teeth. He'd been caught in desert storms before. The lingering effects of Skydark still made the weather not only unpredictable, but vicious. Some peculiar geothermals in Deathlands attracted such bizarre weather as 250-mile-per-hour dust storms. Regardless, he knew that when a storm wind howled across the desert, the only thing to do was to keep moving. If you didn't, you were dead and buried in minutes.
Halt! Everyone drape yourselves in the bed linens, and use belts and straps to keep us connected to one another.
We'll lose the trail when the wind hits.
Yeah, but so far it's been heading northwest. We'll just keep on moving in that direction.
After everyone was attired in the makeshift robes, they got underway. This time, Doc kept up with the others. Inside of the hour, they saw the first tiny dust whirls, lifting and dancing across the terrain. They moved in an erratic jerking pattern, gathering strength from one another. Without warning, the storm struck them broadside, blinding the sky with dust, tearing at everything in its path with a clawing fury. Ryan covered his lower face with a scrap of sheet and turned toward Christy, making sure she held on to her end of the belt in his hand. She was only a few feet away, but almost obscured by the veil of mingled sand and dust. The wind roared around them, setting their sheets to flapping like the wings of giant, ungainly birds.
Keep moving!
The storm slapped at them, pushed them as they staggered and stumbled. Wind-driven grains of sand scoured the exposed part of their bodies like a fiery lash. Blind, half-deafened, and half-suffocated, they fought their way onward, struggling to gain a foot and a yard. No sight of anything was possible. To survive, they had to keep moving. So they plodded onward, linked together, ears filled with the sound of the wind, eyes slitted but seeing nothing but a never-ending curtain of grit. Ryan's feet dragged. He kept himself from falling only by a savage effort of will. Christy lurched into his back, and he reached behind him to give her hand a reassuring squeeze. Ryan pawed the sheet from his face. The air was clear and tranquil. The wind had dropped, and the air around him was no longer clogged with dust and sand.
It's over.
Well, what do you know? We didn't die.
I'm gratified you made that observation. Up until this moment, I was not sure.
All of them dropped in their tracks. They quenched their thirsts and rinsed out their gritty mouths with water. JB fumbled in his coat pocket and brought out his compass.
We didn't stray too far off course. What now?
Only a couple of hours until daybreak. We rest for half an hour, then start moving again.
Do we have to, Dad? I'm beat.
If we stay here, we roast by midday.
Everyone was too tired and thirsty to talk during the half hour. When it elapsed, the seven companions slowly climbed to their feet. Christy pressed herself briefly against Ryan, lips brushing his, but it was a painful kiss, for their lips were dry and raw from the terrible chafing of the wind.
We'll get through this, lover. Been through worse.
Yeah. Shining times await.
Wind-drifted sand glimmered in long ripples, as if a sea had been suddenly frozen and turned to powder. The moon grew red and menacing as it sank. Before they had covered 2 miles, the first glintings of dawn peeped over the horizon. Within 4 miles, the sun topped the edge of the world and drove away the cool of the night. Inside of 6 miles, the air was heavy with radiating waves of sheer, hellish heat. The desert hardpan seemed to soak it up and reflect it back. There was no shelter in sight from the rising inferno. Jack and Christy were fair-skinned and suffered the worst. They bundled themselves in the linens, leaving only their eyes uncovered. They quickly soaked the sheets through with perspiration.
Omnia sol temperat, purus et subtilis.
That's Latin. What's it mean?
The sun, pure and clear, tempers everything.
They slogged on through the sand. Cacti of twisted, distorted shapes grew nearby, but no trees, not even a decent-sized bush. The terrain inclined slightly, and Ryan, his mind clouded by fatigue, was only dimly aware of climbing. His feet slipped on a lip of sand. He went rolling down a smooth slope. Struggling to his hands and knees, Ryan looked up and thought he spotted their salvation. Beneath a shading hand, he squinted through the haze of the skyline at a collection of structures. They looked far away, blurred by the heat shimmer. Distance in the desert couldn't be measured by the eye alone, but he was certain that the buildings were closer than they appeared. Or they could be mirages, fabricated by his brain, slowly boiling away in the pressure cooker of his skull. Even so, the sight of the structures galvanized him, raised him quickly to his feet.
Yeah. Jack, do your eyes still work?
Halfway. Why?
What do you see out there?
Shade.
The settlement, if it could be called that, looked like the rough sketch of a shanty town someone intended to build one day. 2 dozen shelters made of splintering wooden siding and rotted canvas formed a horseshoe shape around a spacious central area. At the apex of the horseshoe, several of the ramshackle structures converged, leaning into one another. The suggestion of a stockade fence was barely identifiable in the drifts. Nothing stirred in and around the structures except wind-driven swirls of sand. On the far side of the settlement, down a short embankment, a thin stream of water trickled, curving around the farthermost outbuilding. A line of gray peaks could just be made out on the distant horizon, mountains or clouds. If they were mountains, it could only be the foothills of the Sierra Madre range. Or it could be a new range, birthed by the Russian Earthshaker bombs that had resculpted much of the west coast. The seven companions cautiously approached the perimeter of the settlement. A square wooden sign hung crookedly on a tall post. The words painted on it were nearly indecipherable due to long exposure to the harsh elements, but Mildred was able to read it.
Fort Fubar. Members of Kiwanis and Rotary Clubs. Population, who gives a shit? Whoever lived here had a sense of humor, at least.
Fubar? What kind of word is that?
Old acronym, dating back to World War II. Fucked up beyond all repair.
Everyone was too hot and tired to expend much energy on laughing. The sun was higher, and the heat increased with every passing minute. Under other circumstances, one or two of their party would enter the potential kill zone for a wreck. There was no time for that now. Sunstroke was a very real possibility, particularly for Jack. Drawing his Sig Sauer, Ryan cycled around into the chamber. He was dismayed by the grating sound made by the slide mechanism. All of their weapons needed to be stripped and cleaned of sand before they were 100% reliable again.
Lock and load. Move in fast and quiet.
The seven people fanned out in a V formation, Ryan taking the point of the wedge. They crept into the perimeter of the settlement, alert for any movement or sound. All they heard was the wind, singing through the grains of sand. The stillness was uncanny. Ryan repressed a shiver, despite the blazing heat, feeling the hairs on his arms and neck stir uneasily. It seemed to him that a silent host of invisible watchers regarded them curiously.
Anything?
Yes. Not danger to us, exactly. Fear. Curiosity. Someone lives here.
Search the houses. Stay on triple red.
They spread out over the settlement, peering into shacks, checking out buildings, no matter how small or ramshackle. Quite a few people had lived here at one time, but they had disappeared. All the structures were empty. The population of Fort Fubar was simply gone. All their tools and belongings and cooking utensils left where they had been last used, as if the people had only stepped away for a second and intended to return in the next second. Moreover, it appeared as if the people had vanished a long time ago, and any clues to their whereabouts had been erased by the merciless passage of years. Several of the Hudson squats were strewed with rubbish, as though a single someone had lived in them until they were so full of trash, he or she was forced to move on. One of the buildings was larger than the others, which wasn't saying much. Its long-ago construction crew had tried to make it two-storied, and called it quits after propping up a sagging loft-type contrivance with crudely hewn square beams. Ryan pushed aside the square of canvas hanging in front of the doorway and made a quick visual circuit of the interior. It had been designed as a storage facility. Crates, boxes, and dirty cloth bundles were stacked to the ceiling. The loft was weighted down with cartons and junk of all sorts. Ryan stepped in, his nose leading his eye to a covered galvanized bucket in a corner. He didn't have to lift the lid to check its contents. The stale air was redolent with the acrid odor of urine and excrement. On a makeshift table, he found a fat candle in a saucer. The melted wax collected at its base was fairly soft. An opened can of tuna lay on the ground. The little remaining in it didn't smell ripe. Ryan backstepped out of the building and gestured for the others to join him.
Somebody's living in here. JB, you, Christy, and Jack come with me.
They entered the building, and Ryan approached the loft. A ladder made of hammered-together 2x4s stretched from the ground to a dark opening. Motioning for the others to remain where they stood, Ryan put his foot on the first rung. The old, dry-rotted wood broke beneath his weight. A dark, ragged shape plummeted from the opening in the underside of the loft, all flailing limbs.
Get on out of here, you hairy sons of whores!
He was a wiry, craggy man, incredibly grimed and browned. His mouth worked in a snag-toothed snarl beneath bewhiskered lips. A foot-long, sharpened shard of metal was gripped in his right hand, with strips of cloth wrapped around the handle. The man made a clumsy stabbing motion, but Ryan was faster, blocking the thrust with his left forearm and knocking the knife from the man's hand with a slashing swipe of his gun. Jack and Christy lunged forward, pistols questing for a clear target, even as the two men grappled. Ryan didn't use his fists on the man, and he resisted the instinct to shoot him dead. He seized the man by the frayed collar of his ragged coverall and pivoted deftly. The man flipped over Ryan's outthrust hip and slammed full length to the floor. A cloud of dust mushroomed up around his body. He lay there, trying to regain the wind the impact with the ground had driven out of him. Ryan knelt beside him, quickly joined by JB, Christy, and Jack.
Who else is with you?
The man had no breath to answer, but he shook his head vigorously, flinging fine particles of dust from his salt-and-pepper hair.
Get the others inside, Christy. The place isn't much, but at least it's out of the sun.
By the time Mildred, Dean, and Doc had entered the storage building, the man had caught his breath enough to talk.
Carter, you come to take me back? Dix, is Trader with you?
Who are you?
Don't recognize me. Been a long time. Long time, yeah.
What's your name?
Danielson. Gunner. War Wag 1.
Dark Knight. Danielson. Remember? Trader gave him the boot for holding out on some stuff from a stockpile we found around Detroit.
Yeah, old field telephones. Weren't worth a crap to anybody. Obsolete before the nuke, even. Trader threw me out, anyhow.
How long ago was that?
Long time, like I said. 17, 18, maybe 19 years. I'm no clock watcher. What are you doing here in the Barrens?
Well, we might ask you the same thing.
Can I sit up?
Do it slow.
Don't see Trader. Where is the hard-assed son of a bitch?
You live alone here?
Yep. Last citizen to Fort Fubar. The only fairer town in the Barrens, if that means anything.
It don't.
You're a long way from your stomping grounds. Where's everybody else?
Taken.
Taken where?
First Kingdom.
Talk sense.
The city of Otten. I lived there, too. For a long time. I was a trusted member of Pharaoh's court. But after Connie died, things changed. I wanted out. I came back here.
You have any idea what he's rambling on about, Millie?
Yes. Let him talk.
I escaped Pharaoh's power, you see.
Danielson tugged open the front of his coverall. Hanging from his weathered neck by a loop of rawhide was an amulet the size of a man's hand. Made of a dull non-reflective metal, it was shaped like a cross with the transverse arm squared and the top rounded.
An Ankh?
Yeah. Keeps Pharaoh's mind out of mine. Not that he noticed he couldn't get in there anymore. Guess even a god king's heart can break. They ain't left me alone out here. Lately, though, the incarnates started nosing around like they were hunting for something. Or somebody.
You, maybe?
Shh. I hear noise. Not sure what it is. Coming closer.
Ryan arose and went to the doorway. Pushing aside the hanging, he looked up and down the sand-swept avenue between the shacks. The others peered through the cracks and chinks in the wallboards. Two shapes came into view from the far end of Fort Fubar.
What the hell?
A pair of two-wheeled vehicles rolled from the direction of the desert, but they didn't resemble in configuration or form other wags he had ever seen. Box-like wooden chassis were overlaid with intricately worked borders of brass, copper, and bronze. The vehicles were 2 yards long, shaped roughly like upside-down elongated U's. They sat on low-slung platforms atop heavy axles, positioned between two very large spoked wheels. The wheels were of some dark wood and rimmed with metal. No power source was visible, though sunlight flashed dazzlingly from a reflective surface at the rear of the platforms. They looked like carts, but they obviously had some artificial source of power.
By the three Kennedys, horseless chariots.
Ryan realized that Doc's description was fairly accurate. He had seen pictures and books of those ancient modes of wheeled transportation. The absence of harnessed horses or other beasts of burden had confused him. As the chariots got closer, Ryan saw that each one carried three man figures, and none of the six looked human at first glance, or even second glance. Mutes was his first thought. A moment later, he was forced to reassess his snap judgment.
Gaia, what are those things?
Each of the six men in the chariots was similar in build and clothing. They were naked except for loosely woven white linen kilts. Glittering collars of beaten gold rested on their broad shoulders and enclosed the bases of their necks. All of them were dark-skinned, deeply tanned by long exposure to the merciless desert sun. In height and breadth, they looked enormous, with heavily muscled arms and legs. Each one held a long, slender silver rod, tipped by V-shaped prongs. Only their heads differentiated them from one another. The men wore jeweled, helmet-like headpieces, which were secured snugly beneath their jaws by an interlocking arrangement of leather straps. One man wore the stylized image of a dog's head, with pricked-up ears and a canine snout. Another headpiece resembled the horned skull of a bull, another a ram, and yet another a scaled, blunt-nosed serpent. A beaked face represented a hawk. Another helmet looked like the head of a crane or a stork.
Major deities of ancient Egypt. Anubis, Serapis, Khnum, Set, Horus, and Tot.
Shit. Stoops in costume.
They are the incarnates.
What are they doing here?
Looking for you, I imagine.
The chariots rolled to simultaneous halts in the center of the compound. As the big helmeted men disembarked, Ryan noticed how they carefully stepped over or around some object at the rear of the vehicles. Their gait was an arrogant, self-confident swagger. High-strapped sandals encased their feet and muscular calves.
Osorkin! Where are you, you demented old prick?
Who's Osorkin?
Me, my Otten name.
What do you mean they're looking for us?
They probably seen your tracks.
And if you're asked about us, you'll simply point us out to them?
They're the incarnates. You don't lie to them.
Osorkin!
What do they want us for?
To bring you to Pharaoh. They probably have need of you in the work gangs. You won't be hurt unless you take the notion into your heads to resist.
Funny thing. That's exactly the notion I've taken into my head.
We take them out. They're not armed except for frog giggers.
Not armed, Boy, they got metal rods. They'll drop you like fried flounders.
Sirkin, get out here or we'll burn this shit heap down.
Hold a sec, Ryan. I got an idea.
I am delighted that somebody does.